Welcome to a very special edition of Power Play this Remembrance Day, as we remember those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our peace and security and thank those who have served. We have quite the lineup today to help us pay tribute, including the Silver Cross mother, a Special Forces veteran, and the Minister of Veterans Affairs, Kent Hare. He'll be here with an update on his government's progress on that file. Also ahead, a project in BC is sharing personal letters and images from Canadian soldiers to help bring history to life for students. I'll speak with the project's director, and we'll also take a look at the challenges facing young veterans. Many of them feel they are home, but the war has not ended. We'll take a look at the issue of homelessness among veterans. And the Canadian War Museum is working on a new exhibit that will remember the last Canadian soldier killed in the First World War, just 2 minutes before the armistice. But first, marking Remembrance Day here in the nation's capital.
They shall grow not old as we that are left grow old.
The Prime Minister, along with many veterans and dignitaries, paid their respect at the National War Memorial to those who have sacrificed so much for our country so that we can live and do as we please. And today, Justin Trudeau is urging all Canadians to take a few moments to remember those who lost their lives in wars past and present.
We remember yesterday's youth, far from home, who fought for reason and progress, who stood up to tyranny and stood for liberty, and sacrificed their future for the future of many. We honor Canada's bravest, who stand shoulder to shoulder with our allies around the world every day, who face down the threat of terrorism and protect the values we cherish most.
Veterans Affairs Minister Kent Hare was one of the parliamentarians attending today's ceremony at the National War Memorial, and he joins us now. Minister, you had a chance to speak with a number of the veterans there today. I'm curious to know what they had to say to you, what the feeling was among those veterans.
Well, the feeling amongst the veterans is they're always proud to be at the National Memorial, where we get together to celebrate and honor the service and the sacrifice of the 2.3 million Canadians who have served in our armed forces since Confederation. And talking about with them about their contributions in Korea, the peacekeeping missions. There were some members from World War II there. It was a really special day to be there, and understanding it from their perspective truly means a lot. And to be there for the second year was an amazing event for me personally, because you understand your file better. You understand the importance of veterans and their families and how they truly mean so much to our peace, security, and what we've not only accomplished as a country, but how we continue to rely on our Canadian Armed Forces for our security each and every day.
How big of a challenge is it to be dealing with not only veterans from the Second World War in Korea, who have very different needs, but veterans, frankly, who are coming back from Iraq now, Special Forces, who are there right now? It's such a tremendous age range and such different kinds of needs, all unique, all important.
You're perfectly correct in identifying one of the issues, is that I have people in my department who utilize our services who are 19 years old and who are old as 100. And they have a different set of needs, a different set of wants and abilities, how they move their lives forward in a reasonable, progressive fashion. So that makes a challenge. And in particular, we've had a relatively similar department for the last 40 years. And we've added a program here, added a program there, changed some things to a program without really doing a full-scale analysis and what will make the whole system work better for everyone. I think that's what we're doing right now with my work with Minister Sajjan on closing the seam between the Canadian Armed Forces and Veterans Affairs Canada, how we can assist more veterans get better outcomes. I think it's...
And that's been a pretty substantial seam. There's been a lot of people that fall in between the cracks in terms of getting their pensions, for example.
Without a doubt. 75% of our people leave the Canadian Armed Forces good to go. They're fully ready back into society and everything runs smoothly.
75%?
25% struggle. And that's far too high of number. We need to get better outcomes, better ability to tap them into financial resources, employment opportunities, return to school, an ability to build their lives. And that's the work we've started to do in the department in budget 2016 when we delivered $5.6 billion in financial services, made some amendments to financial security and other programs. But I think that's where the next tranche of where we're going with Minister John is. How do we get better outcomes for our men and women who have served this nation so greatly, so boldly, so proudly? How do we get them better outcomes to be part of the middle class, part of building their lives in a progressive fashion? And I sense we're making very good progress on that front.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about some of that progress. Something I hear a lot from veterans is questions about the pension. A lot voted for your government based on the promises that were made to veterans. And I know you fulfilled a number of them. But as you know, the pension for many is a real sticking point. Yeah. Are we getting close?
Well, we've accomplished so far 6 of our 15 mandate letter items. I still have 9 to go. We remain committed to each and every line item on that mandate, including an option for a pension for life for our veterans. We need to ensure that our people who need the help and support, who have incurred disabilities and illnesses as a result of their service, are financially taken care of. We know that, and we want to present that option in a clear manner that allows them to build their lives and allows them to be able to take care of them and their families, frankly. They have served in our military. We have universality of service. So if you're no longer able to do that job, you can't go back and do your chosen career, which is very difficult. And we have to ensure we have an ability that they see their services reconcile with a reasonable financial compensation that looks at how they can keep their lives moving in a progressive fashion.
Minister Kent Hare, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, earlier today, I had the honor of being part of CTV's Remembrance Day special and had the chance to speak with Master Warrant Officer Darren Little. Little is a retired Special Forces veteran who comes from a long line of military men. And today he shared what Remembrance Day means for our most secret warriors, those whose missions save lives but are often never publicly acknowledged. So, Master Warrant Officer Darren Little, you're a legend in the Special Forces community. You're here today at Remembrance Day. What does it mean for Special Forces veterans who so often have to operate in the dark without recognition of what they're doing when you reflect on what you and your previous colleagues and those who are still overseas deployed are doing for Canada?
Well, because I know that a lot of my former colleagues and friends and so on are going to be seeing this, legend is your word, not mine.
It's accurate.
But I'd like to say, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be standing here today to say a few words on their behalf, because they don't get the opportunity to say anything publicly normally. When I speak from a special operations perspective specifically, I know that no matter where operators are working around the world, and they're in far flung places around the globe, and they're operating every day. When Remembrance Day comes around, it's a very special time for all of us. And no matter where we are, no matter what we're doing, we find a way to take a moment, even if it's not specifically on Remembrance Day, to remember the fallen, to pay tribute.
You and I were chatting before, and we were talking about the sacrifices that are made not just by those in uniform, but by the families who support those in uniform, including your wife, who's also served in the Canadian Forces.
That's right.
Special Forces families have a special challenge because they can't always tell people where their spouse is or what they're doing. What does today mean for those Special Forces families, and what kind of challenges and recognition do they need?
Well, I know my wife Cindy is here today, and she served in the military, as you alluded to as well. I met her while she was serving, and she gave up her career to follow me as I pursued my dreams in the Canadian Armed Forces. And that went everywhere from, you know, the now defunct Canadian Overrun Regiment, you know, to the PPCLI, and then on to Special Operations. Throughout all that time, you know, I refer to her as the actual secret team that keeps the machine going at home. It keeps the family running. And it's the spouses who, you know, they raise the kids, they pay the bills, they keep the household running, they keep the vehicles maintained, all so that, you know, I can be somewhere in the world working on behalf of Canada. And they recently were recognized at my last medal ceremony before I released. And it meant more to me than any accolades I'd ever received to see my wife finally being recognized for the contribution that she gives to the country that goes even less recognized than the ones in uniform.
Now, you're also third generation Canadian Forces. Your father served, your brother served, your grandfather served. What is it like to have that kind of a family legacy of service? Such incredible sacrifice for Canada.
Well, you know, like a lot of Canadian families, my grandfather, you know, he signed up when he was underage. He was in World War I. He fought at several battles. He was a sharpshooter. He was actually buried alive at one point from artillery shelling at Vimy Ridge, if I'm not mistaken. So I grew up hearing these stories, and so the military was ingrained in my blood. My father served a full career, and most of his brothers also served full careers. So it was kind of a no-brainer that I was going to join. And from the day I did join, I just kept seeking that, you know, I wanted to get better, I wanted to get better, I wanted to get better. So I kept moving from unit to unit until, you know, fortunately for me, during my time, CANSOF was stood up, and I was able to become a member of it early on. And I ended up doing the majority of my career with CANSOF. And so I can look back on that with a lot of gratitude. It gave me the opportunity to have what I consider a terrific career.
Final question, what is the message that you'd like to send to Canadians today?
I guess, you know, as I alluded to earlier, there are Canadian special operators working around the world at any given time. And a lot of times their deeds go unnoticed, unrecognized by the public. They are very well recognized by, you know, by the government and by the military and stuff like that. But a lot of times it's stories that just don't come out for many, many years, if they ever do. What I would like to ask of all my fellow Canadians is that know that, you know, there are men operating on your behalf, doing the work of our country all the time. And when you get the chance to meet one of them, give them a pat on the back and say thanks.
Well, thank you so much for your service and for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
And I appreciate it very much, too. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. To Washington now, where Ambassador David McNaughton and the Canadian Embassy marked Remembrance Day. Every year, the ceremony takes place in the embassy's courtyard. Following the ceremony, members of the Canadian Armed Forces in the American capital gathered at the Canadian Cross of Sacrifice at Arlington National Cemetery to lay wreaths. When we return, the Silver Cross mother honors her fallen son and all mothers who have lost their sons and daughters in the service of their country. Please stay with us. It is an honor that no mother wants. The Silver Cross mother represents all mothers who have lost a daughter or son serving Canada. Colleen Fitzpatrick laid a wreath at the National War Memorial today in one of the most poignant moments of the ceremony, driving home that the sacrifice of war is not only those in uniform, but also the pain of their families. I had the privilege of interviewing Corporal Darren Fitzpatrick's mother earlier this week.
What does it mean to you to be the Silver Cross mother?
Well, to start, I would have to say it's surreal. It's a very surreal experience. You don't ever expect to be the Silver Cross mother when your loved one signs up. It's not something that you want to think about. But now that I'm here, I reflect and I think about what an honor it is. There are so many families that struggle, that have loved ones that they've lost in the service of our country. And to think about being a representative for them is very humbling.
Can you tell us a bit about Darren? the boy that he was and then the man that he became?
For sure. Darren was our middle son of three boys, crazy redhead, full of life. He was just such an energetic young man, and grew into be such a respectful, compassionate, giving young man. It was in his mind he was going to go out and make a difference. He just decided that that was for him, and he was willing to take whatever the risk.
And when he was in Afghanistan and he called home and talked to you, or he wrote home, what did he tell you about being there? What was that like for him?
He didn't share a lot of detail. He did tell us a few stories, and for Darren it was always focused around the people, what he saw there. And I think for Darren it just reiterated why he was there.
Darren stepped on an IED in March of 2010. Tell me about that day. What happened?
We were in Mexico on our 25th wedding anniversary at the time. So the notification came home to Sean, our youngest son, and we were contacted in Mexico, and we were advised that Darren was out on a foot patrol and had stepped on an IED. Early on, we didn't have a lot of the details, but we were told that he was in critical condition.
What goes through your mind as his mother when you get that phone call in Mexico?
Your biggest fear, of course. But the message that we received was that he was critical. He was still alive. So there's always hope. So at that point, it was hour by hour. He's alive. We just need to get to him.
And when you walked into his hospital room in Germany, what condition was he in? Were you able to talk to him?
Not initially. He was heavily sedated because of the major trauma to his legs. They had him significantly sedated. But one thing I did note when we entered the room is that his face was beautiful. He looked really good. He was peaceful. His eyes were closed. But his face and everything looked really good. He had lost his total blood volume out in the field. We were told that it was a medical miracle that he survived the blast, and then to make it to Kandahar and receive such significant donations to keep him alive, and then to get him to Germany, it was a miracle. It was pretty phenomenal, actually.
And giving blood has become something that's a priority for your family, something that's important to you?
Yeah, it has definitely become a passion for the family. It was our opportunity to pay it forward. You know, for other families, it saves a life. Right? Or, you know, it prolongs a life.
Those must have been incredibly difficult days for your family.
It was emotional for sure and very difficult, but, you know, we wouldn't trade it for anything. There were two precious weeks that we got to spend that most families don't have that opportunity. So we certainly know that we were blessed with those 2 weeks.
And he wanted to come home to Canada.
He did. That was his one request. Yeah.
And was he able to tell you that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that was our goal, was to get him medically stable so that he could make the long flight home. He wasn't conscious when he was in Alberta, but I'm sure he felt our presence and he knew we were all there.
I know that there is a park named after him. Tell me about that park, and when you go there, do you feel him?
For sure. It's a very special place. The Darren Fitzpatrick Bravery Park. And it's a park with a theme of remembrance and bravery. It's in the neighborhood where he grew up. And he played Little League, attended daycare. So it's definitely a happy place for us.
And it brings solace to you in a way that visiting his final resting place doesn't.
The cemetery is a place of finality. And I don't feel his presence there like I do where Darren would be having fun and enjoyment at the park. That's where we'd feel his presence.
It is an unthinkable loss to go through what you've gone through. Where do you draw strength to do this and to be able to speak to Canadians about what this means?
Well, at a time of tragedy, our family has tried to keep Darren's legacy alive, be positive, and find strength. It's just, you know, Darren was such a positive, full of life individual that's what he would want. And so that's part of his legacy as well. And we will work hard to pay it forward, keep Darren's memory alive. And I guess that's where I find my strength.
You're here now as the Silver Cross mother, which is an honor no mother hopes to ever receive. And you're going to be laying the wreath at the National War Memorial. Do you think Darren would be proud of you?
He would be, for sure. And he'll be with us. It takes a very special individual to put on the uniform and step forward to serve. And for all of our sons and daughters, that's what I'll be thinking of, our freedoms, because they served.
Canadian troops carry out dangerous and selfless missions around the world, but when they return home, many find their struggle is not over and end up on the streets. After the break, a different kind of Canadian hero who is on the front lines fighting to help homeless vets. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the show. A disturbing statistic now. Last year, a federal report found that 2,200 Canadian veterans use shelters on a regular basis, a shocking number that so many who have served somehow seem to come home and find themselves struggling for something as basic as shelter. Today, we'll meet a veteran who is literally walking the streets looking to help homeless vets through his charity. Jim Lowther is an Armed Forces veteran himself and the president and CEO of Veterans Emergency Transition Services. He joins us now from Halifax. Jim, can you give us a sense of, the report says 2,200 vets. Do you think that that's an accurate number? How big is this problem?
We think the number is a lot bigger than that, Mercedes. There's just based on, I mean, our organization, we've helped 1,400 homeless and in crisis veterans alone. So we think the number is definitely bigger than that.
What are some of the reasons that these veterans find themselves in the situation where they're ending up on the streets and you're having the opportunity to talk to them? What are they telling you about the challenges they're facing?
Well, I find a lot of them are having a rough time transitioning. You know, they go from the military where they're productive and active and they have to get out due to injury. And, you know, they don't have work and a lot of them have PTSD, we find. And it's a slow spiral down to, you know, where they end up homeless or in crisis.
And when they're in crisis, your organization's incredible. I've seen you at work on the streets. I've followed you around and watched what you do. You move so quickly to get people off the streets. What are the key steps that need to be offered, the resources these veterans need to be able to move forward with their lives and start a successful reintegration?
Well, we move quickly because when we find a vet that's in crisis, I mean, you know, things need to happen quickly. And that's the great thing about Vets Canada and our volunteers. You know, a lot of them are still serving. A lot of them are veterans. So they know exactly what kind of help that our veterans need. And we use, we're all donations. So, you know, we have the money to be able to say we find a vet, like when you were out with us in Ottawa, you know, a vet who's homeless, he wants to get off the street, we immediately get him into a hotel. We do a needs assessment. We bring our team in to do a needs assessment. We find out, we contact Veterans Affairs right away to find out if they're entitled to any benefits that they didn't even know they're entitled to. And we work with helping them with their paperwork and we actually help them find apartments and we pay first and last month's rent. We help them with furniture. We help them with food. Anything you can imagine, Vets Canada is there to help with. And we can only do it through donations.
Well, and Jim, this incredible work your organization is doing, you also have another side to it, and that's that you try to prevent veterans who are at risk of becoming homeless. For example, I've talked to a number of veterans who say that they don't get their pension, sometimes for 6 or 9 months. They simply can't make ends meet. I'm wondering if you can give us some insight into how common that is and how many veterans might be at risk of becoming homeless because of that transition gap.
Yes, that's definitely a problem that we're seeing a lot of, unfortunately. What happens is you know, these men and women are getting out of the military and they're doing the right thing. They're saving enough money for 3 months or 4 months waiting for their pension. So, but the thing is, you know, if it's anything more than 4, 5, 6, 8 months, no one has the finances to be able to do that. So, you know, they start missing a mortgage payment. They start not paying bills. That's where we come in. We come in to help them with help them float for a couple of months. We pay a mortgage payment or two or three. We help them with bills. But this is a major problem across the country. And, you know, people are looking into it. So it's not one of those things where, you know, no one's doing anything about it. You know, people are looking into it, and hopefully we can get it sorted out soon.
Jim, what can people out there who are watching at home and who are shocked by this story that there's thousands of homeless veterans do to help?
Well, you know, we have an army of volunteers from coast to coast. These are the best people. They're kind, caring Canadians. And like I said earlier, we can only do this on donations. And 100% of all donations go back to homeless and in crisis veterans. We every cent that comes in goes out. And we can do this because we are all volunteers, myself and my wife included, who founded Vets Canada. And that's how we work. We're volunteers who the need is out there, and we're just doing what we can to help as many as we can to end homelessness. I believe, and I have faith, I believe that we can end homelessness in Canada. Canadians are kind and caring, and they can move mountains. So, you know, I have hope and faith.
Jim Lowther, doing incredible work. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Coming up, a University of British Columbia is digitizing images, newspaper clippings, and letters written by soldiers themselves to tell the stories of Canada's war experience from a first-person perspective. After the break, the project's director joins us to discuss this massive undertaking. You won't want to miss it. Vancouver Island University is helping make history come alive as part of a project that archives firsthand accounts of Canada's wartime experience. So far, they've collected over 25,000 personal photographs and letters written by Canadian soldiers through the country's long and storied military history. Some of the letters have even been voiced by famous Canadians to help engage the kids. Here's astronaut Chris Hadfield reading from a letter written by a pilot in the First World War.
I've been a long time writing again, as usual, but out here, no one seems to think about writing much, and I've been here 6 months. I think I came out almost immediately after I wrote you last. I remember I was doing ferry work then between England and Paris, but it did not last long, and I was soon sent off with the rest of the wing in time to join in on one of the first raids. Several boys were lost, but I had luck and got back all right.
What a cool project. For more on it, we're joined by Project Director Stephen Davies. Stephen, I want to ask you, what's the intent behind this project when you set out?
Originally, it was meant as a small project, perhaps a few hundred letters for my students, because I think that the letters are so powerful in understanding what the war experience means and putting a human face to war. So it was really a way of seeing a war through the eyes and the words of the participants themselves rather than a history text.
Well, and it's such an incredible personalization of the war that they're not just reading it in a book or hearing about it, but to imagine what it might be like for the person who's going through it. Is that part of what led you to asking well-known Canadians to voice some of these letters, to give it that humanity? I mean, obviously it's humanity in what's written, but to really give that connection and to make it feel real.
I think so. It's very much when you hear the spoken letter, it's so powerful, rather than simply reading it, perhaps skimming it over, and to hear people reading it. So we wanted to be able to bring in letters which would make the project more accessible for the visually handicapped. And then we asked some of these Canadians if they would be willing to participate. And it's very interesting because as busy as they are, they're donating their time for free to read these letters. They believe it's important.
Well, and who are some of the Canadians beside astronaut Chris Hadfield who have joined you in this project to literally give their voices to it?
Well, on site right now, as they come in, we put them on. So His Excellency the Governor General is there, Georgina Riley, Cynthia Dale, R.H. Thompson is there. People who have committed include Rick Mercer, Dan Aykroyd, Dave Thomas, Paul Gross, Alan Hocko, Karen Kane. They've all committed to read letters for us.
That's fantastic. And how do the students react to this?
It's a very emotional experience, particularly the ones who work for me, but even when I use them in the classroom, because it reminds them that when they go to the cenotaph, for example, today, and they see the veterans and they're old and they assume they kind of make that connection that they're always old, and they start to read the letters and realize that they're just like them. They're 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old kids who had lives and loves and ambitions and all these sorts of things just like them. I think it really hits home then what those statistics really mean and what those names on the cenotaph really mean.
Stephen, what inspired you to do this?
I did have a grandfather in World War I. Didn't leave really any letters, but he left his diaries. And ever since I was younger, I was fascinated by that social side of the war, the people's story, if you will, home front and battle front. So that's, I think, really what inspired me. And the more letters I read, the more I became immersed in the kind of world, that personal world that we don't see normally in the war side books and textbooks.
Now, Stephen, if people are watching this at home and maybe they have their father or their grandfather or their grandmother's letters, how can they get them to you so they can become a part of this history coming to life?
Well, we're always looking for new materials. If you go onto our website, canadianletters.ca, contact information is there. What we do as an online archive, we don't keep any materials. So we ask to borrow them. We'll make arrangements at our expense to courier them out here. We digitize them. Then they go back to the families. So that way the family can hold on to them, but share this very important story of Canada's past.
And why do you think it's important for young people to understand that past?
I think it's easy to forget because we're losing that generation of visible veterans. When you go to the cenotaph, that the veterans simply aren't there in the numbers they used to. And I think it's easy to, almost, I don't want to say trivialize, but nonetheless forget the importance of these individuals. So I think what's important about these letters is that they're not the generals that we might read about in the textbook. These are ordinary Canadians, largely forgotten, but who deserve to be remembered for what they did for us and what they did for the country overall.
And out of a day of remembrance, we'll do just that. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Mercedes.
Well, outside of Canada, ceremonies were held around the world today to honor those who served their countries and those who did not come home. Prince Harry marked Remembrance Day at a service at the National War Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire. He read Rupert Brooke's poem, The Soldier. It was written at the beginning of the war. And Prince Charles attended a memorial service in Manama, Bahrain, on the last day of his royal tour of the Middle East. The Prince of Wales laid a wreath at the British Embassy there. After the break, we will learn about the upcoming exhibit at the Canadian War Museum honoring the very last Canadian killed in the First World War. Please stay with us. Welcome back. The Canadian War Museum just acquired artifacts awarded to Private George Lawrence Price, the last Canadian killed during the First World War. Earlier this week, I spoke with Tim Cook, the museum's historian, about the incredible story of Private Price and the cost of the First World War. So, Tim, we're here today at the Canadian War Museum, and we're talking about the final soldier to be killed in the First World War, the tragic distinction of being the last soldier to die just 2 minutes before the armistice. What can you tell us about Private George Price?
Well, Private Price was born in Nova Scotia, but like many men from his time, he moved west. He enlisted in August of 1917, and he was serving overseas with the 28th Battalion, which was a battalion from Saskatchewan for the most part. He fought in 1918 at the front. He was a good soldier. He was gassed in one attack. But really his distinction, as you mentioned, is from the last day of the war, November 11th. And at this time, there were rumors swirling that Germany was going to surrender. The soldiers at the front didn't know that. But of course, their politicians were negotiating a surrender. Austria-Hungary had surrendered. Turkey had surrendered. It looked like the war was over. And Private Price was leading a section forward on a patrol. And it's a bit unclear as to why he was doing this, because their commanding officer had received news that the war would end at 11, around 9 in the morning, so 2 hours, and he told his guys, go to ground. But Private Price wanted to lead his men forward, and he crossed a canal, and this was maybe 10, 15 minutes before the armistice. And then the story of his death is a little bit conflicted. There are a number of stories. One of them is that he saw a young girl, a woman, in a window. This was northeast of Mons. And he rose from his trench, and he sort of rose and wanted to greet her, maybe give her a kiss, maybe to tell her that he was liberating her. And then he was shot by a sniper. Another story is that, of course, he was just leading his men forward and he was killed by a sniper. Either way, he was shot around 10:52, 10:53. His comrades pulled him back, they tried to save him, and he died at 10:58. And he was the last Canadian killed in the tragic First World War.
And there's some sad irony to where he is buried. My understanding is it was quite close to another significant death in the war.
That's right. The first British soldier, a Private Parr, was killed on the 21st of August. He's thought to be the first British soldier killed in the war. And this was outside of Mons. So this is where the British Army was retreating before the German forces. And he was killed, and he's buried. And Private Price is buried about 30 meters away from him. And there's something very sad, very tragic, I think, about the first and the last soldier killed. This is a war, of course, fought by empires, fought around the world, on the Eastern Front, on the Italian Front, in Africa, in the Middle East, on the Western Front, on the oceans. It involves 60 or 70 million combatants, 9 million killed on the battlefield, the destruction of empires. And here we have the first and the last soldier. And in fact, all of that fighting to get back to the start line.
Wow, incredibly sad. And you've had a chance, I understand, to acquire the medals from Private Price that are actually going to be displayed here in the museum. What can you tell me about that?
They came from a Legion in Nova Scotia. They had been with the Legion for 30 or 40 years. Price's family was from Nova Scotia. He was, of course, killed, and like all soldiers who were killed in the war, are 60,000 wartime dead, another 6,000 who died immediately afterwards. And the survivors, they were given the victory medals, and they wore these medals, the survivors did, and their families, those next of kin, received those medals. They went to his family, obviously, and they were donated to the Legion at some point. The Legion isn't sure, but they'd been there for several decades. And they, I think, decided that they wanted to send them to the War Museum, where they would be put on display, really for all Canadians. We get about 500,000 visitors a year, and they will be a part of a major exhibition in 2018, which covers the 100 Days campaign. And this was the series of battles where the Canadian Corps, led by Sir Arthur Currie, probably our finest battlefield general, delivered a series of victories that ultimately ended the war on November 11th, 1918.
Tim, thank you so much for telling us the story of Private Price. Obviously, a very sad one. We remember all of the soldiers who have lost their lives in the wars that Canada's fought in, and I'm sure we'll have lots of Canadians coming down here to see your excellent displays. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Time to bring in our Friday Press Gallery panel. Tonda McCharles is with the Toronto Star, and Craig Oliver is CTV's senior political commentator. You know, Remembrance Day is always such a time that it's very powerful everywhere. It's very powerful in Ottawa, where you see all these people who are still serving in uniform and their families. Tonda, this is a government that made a lot of promises to veterans, and there's been some dissatisfaction with veterans among how they're doing with those promises. Mm-hmm. What work do you think they have left to do?
It seems they have quite a bit of work. You know, I know I've heard the Minister of Veteran Affairs today, Kent Hare, appeal for a bit more patience and more wiggle room around giving him time to sort of integrate and deal with the benefits issue, deal with housing issue, deal with reintegration into the job market issues. They say they've reopened the service counters across the country, and they point to that as progress. But I think that many veterans are looking for progress within their own daily lives, right? And so I think they still have quite a bit from what I hear, from what you folks all talk about when, you know, when you're talking to these people, right? They make compelling stories, every one of them.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm not trying to point blame at anyone, because I think anyone could have made the mistakes they made, because I think they just simply were not prepared. It had been so long since we'd had troops in combat. The government was not prepared to deal with first the deaths, which is the easiest to deal with, but all of the wounded people. Mm-hmm. They just weren't prepared. It totally overwhelmed them, and they still haven't quite caught up to it.
Both physically and mentally wounded.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting today that the Canadian Forces chaplain talked about those who had taken their own lives.
Yeah.
That recognition, we're now seeing medals awarded to families who have lost soldiers to suicide. Is the culture starting to finally shift?
You know, it must be, because even when some of the veterans I spoke to down on the square today, just because I saw this little girl handing out roses to people, and I find, anyway, some of them more readily acknowledge that they're struggling. They name it PTSD. I have PTSD. I was discharged. CTV had an amazing story last night about how many of the veterans don't go out to the ceremony because it stresses them. To be there even today. I find the frank acknowledgement around it and the candor with which people acknowledge it seems to me to signal there are some advances being made here.
Here's something I've wondered for a long time and wonder if it might change. Why is Veterans Affairs a whole separate bureaucracy? Why isn't it under the Defense Minister? Why shouldn't it be? Much more simpatico, dealing with their own. I think it would be far more effective. And I believe that's the way we should go. And I don't know why the government couldn't make that change.
Well, certainly that gap is a significant challenge. We heard that from a lot of veterans. We heard from the organization today that works with homeless vets and tries to prevent them from becoming homeless. Mm-hmm. Tonda, how much time do you think this government has left before vets run out of patience with them?
Hmm. It's hard to say, you know. I mean, it depends on if they're able to make some progress in some files in the next year or so, even say. I still think this government has a lot of political goodwill, some political capital that they haven't yet spent. And we'll see, I think, over the course of the next legislative session, how long it'll take for that to erode. But I think there's still some patience there, but your guess is as good as mine, really. Won't it take a couple of really compelling stories where someone is badly treated, I think? Maybe, you know, they're one really bad headline away from a lot of pressure. We don't know.
Craig, you have witnessed many Remembrance Days. You've participated in them. Do you get that sense that Canada remembers? Certainly during Afghanistan, there was an increased awareness after the attacks, the attack on Parliament Hill there was. What about this year? Do you think Canadians are sustaining that remembering of those who have sacrificed?
I think they will, because more than in the past. I mean, for 30 years, you could join the Army and have a lifetime career and never hear a shot fired in anger. That's changed dramatically in the last generation. And so I think the more Canadians read about soldiers getting wounded, killed, see it on television, I think the more they appreciate the self-sacrifice, especially younger people who, parents like me, the kids were coddled, and they didn't know what self-sacrifice was all about, and I think they appreciate it.
I know that the schools make such a tremendous effort, way more than they did in our day. My kids were both at assemblies in their school. There's tremendous projects, and, you know, those things you were talking about earlier, the digitization of the stories and the memories and the artifacts. For a digital generation, that will connect them to stories, you know, and so I think there is. That crowd down at the National War Memorial every year seems to me to grow. Not,
and that wasn't true 25 or 30 years ago. The crowds were dropping off and vets were dropping off, and the interest seemed to be waning, which hurt a lot of people. And that's all changing. And look at the hits, hundreds of thousands of hits, maybe millions, I don't know, on the War Museum line online.
And look, the stories are being told in so many different ways. There's all kinds of money pouring into telling those stories in television series, in movies, you know. And so I think that is connecting. Maybe I want to be optimistic about it.
All of this is another good reason why I hope the government decides to have a vote in Parliament on this next sojourn by the troops, wherever it is in Africa. And my friend here just had a great interview with the minister, by the way.
Thanks, Frank.
I think nobody should have, no soldier should have to put his or her life on the line without Parliament having said, yes, this is something we should do because these are values we should fight for.
Well, and there's no question that if there is a peacekeeping mission to Africa,
legally,
which we expect there to be, there will be risk. And there is the possibility of casualties and another generation of veterans from another conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it was somewhat, the timing of that interview was coincidence, but I think it was a good one to hear today.
I have to wrap it up there because we are out of time, but thank you so much to our press gallery panel. And that's your week in Canadian politics. A big thank you to our crews and producers. And today, of course, a big thank you to our veterans who have served. Lois Lee is up next with the latest headlines. And today, as many Canadians are remembering the life and legacy of Canadian singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, we'll leave you now with a haunting reading of In Flanders Fields that Cohen recorded last year for Remembrance Day. For the Power Play team, I'm Mercedes Stevenson, and Don Martin will be back at this time right here on Monday on CTV News Channel.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. And now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Fields.